Today's episode is brought to you by the Strand Tennis Center. Located just 40 minutes outside of Manhattan, the Strand is the tennis brainchild of owner Stephen Capo, and it's my favorite facility to sweat, learn, and have fun while playing tennis. Follow the Strand on Instagram or Twitter at Strand Tennis for more information. Welcome back, everyone. I'm so excited we're all together again this week. I really appreciate you tuning us in. I've been loving waking up to all the tennis in Paris all week. It is so much fun. I love this time zone. So much easier than Australia. As of today, all the favorites are still hanging on. Rafa Nadal had a crazy five-setter today against Felix, and he's now set up a blockbuster quarterfinal against an in-form Novak that hasn't lost a set yet this entire event. That match is for sure the biggest quarterfinal I can remember on the men's side at the French Open, maybe ever. The favorite on the ladies' side is also at the top of the draw. And of course, we all know who that is. It's Iga. And she's been so dominant this year and continues her now 31-match win streak, inching so much closer to Serena Williams' mark of 34 set back in 2013. And she continues her quest for a second French Open title. It seems like it's hers to lose at this point. She's looking so great. We've got to do a French Open recap because there's just too much to unpack here. I mean, there's so much I want to talk about. Like the bottom half of the ladies' draw, it's been such a surprise. And now we have an exciting quarterfinal that's been set up with Americans Coco Gauff and Sloane Stephens. So great to see Sloane coming through that section so unexpectedly, especially after, I don't know, I guess I'll say lackluster clay court season warm-up. I mean, not many would have predicted Sloane was going to be here in the quarterfinals of the French after some of her warm-up matches, but I love it. That's the French. It's so unpredictable. It always is. Always is. I have so many childhood memories of watching such great French Open matchups. I mean, Selys and Graf and Pierce and Capriati, Bruguera, Safin, so many. The list is so long, and it's a huge reason why I'm so excited for today, because I really am grateful you're all listening out there. And although we didn't get to speak about it on today's show, our guest, 2004 French Open mixed doubles champion Tatiana Golovin, is about to start the Legends event in Paris this week. It is a ridiculous draw, probably the best Legends draw I've ever seen, for sure. You have Davenport and Pierce and Navratilova and Sabatini back in the draw. Gabriela Sabatini, are you kidding me? You got Flavia Panetta, Renee Stubbs, Chanda Rubin, Sandrine Testud. Come on. This is a ridiculous draw. I'm so excited for this week. And Tatiana is playing with Natalie Tosia. So, I mean, this is going to be fun. Eva Maioli, come on. So many fun names. I do want to say, before we jump into today's show, I learned so much about this great champion this week. I still can't imagine working so hard your entire life to get so close to the top 10 and achieving your life dreams. And then in an instant, your body says, you know what? Nah, I'm done. And then poof, your life is completely changed forever. And luckily, we'll hear that Tatiana was so young in her career when it was taken away from her. And we'll learn today how she coped with that mentally and hear how she was able to really have a life outside of tennis and a life without tennis. I love today's show. I loved her optimism and I loved the stories that she told. So I was a big fan before, and after today, I'm a lifelong fan, and I hope she has the absolute best time on court this week. Tatiana, if you're listening, I really hope you get to play one more match on that big, beautiful center court and have a proper send-off. And I hope you all enjoy this week's episode. It's the career and life of Tatiana Golovin. Also, go ahead and take a shot for every time I mispronounce someone's name this episode. This could be its own drinking game. I can't remember how many times I've mispronounced Kukulova in my entire life. So have fun. Enjoy this week's episode.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
I mean, they always have a big mouth, they always talk a lot, so it happened before, it's gonna happen again.
This week's fan guest is a huge tennis fan from Baltimore, Maryland, USA, and he's one of the big reasons I love doing this show. He reached out to me on Instagram after listening to an episode, and we instantly fan bonded over our love of the game. I was happy to find out he's also a huge fan of our guest today, and considers himself a great luck charm, as he was in the stands watching as our guest defeated Ai Sugiyama in straight sets at the 2006 Stanford event. It's my new friend, Emmett Stanton. Emmett, great to finally meet you.
Likewise, John.
This is great. I loved when I found out that you're Team Golovin. That was like awesome. I was like, perfect. What a great coincidence.
I will say right now, reason number one, we were born the same week. So she was the first player who appeared in the scene who I could relate to exactly because we were the same age.
Oh, I love it. That's, you know, fan culture is so fun. It's going to be great unpacking her career today for sure. But before we bring her out, you told me something that I loved. You alluded to the reason why you think you were destined to be a major tennis fan. And it was because of your mom and a very special match.
That's right. My mother went to university at Rice in Texas, in Houston, Texas. And she happened to be in the stands for the Battle of the Sexes match between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs. All the girls from her college dorm got together and went to the match to cheer on Billie Jean. And, you know, I think that's part of why I'm a good luck charm to this day.
What was the vibe? Did she tell you? I bet it was just crazy.
You know, it was the 70s and it was the height of women's lib. And so her entire college got together and there were so many women in the stands cheering for Billie Jean. And the energy was just out of this world. It still is one of the most watched television events there ever was. So it's pretty remarkable to know that she was there for that piece of history. And, you know, I've not been there for quite the same history, but I've gotten to enjoy a lot of tennis as a consequence of her fandom.
I love that story. I love that story. Billie Jean King certainly paved the way to have amazing female athletes in the world, like our guest today. So let's bring her out. Our player guest this week is a big fan favorite whose career, we can all agree, was cut way too short by injury. But what she was able to do with her time on the court was truly remarkable. Born in Moscow, Russia, she would move to Paris as an infant and spend her career playing proudly under the French flag, competing in both Hopman Cup and Fed Cup team competitions. Most notably, beating then world number 5, Svetlana Kuznetsova, during an electrifying 2004 Fed Cup finals match in Moscow. As a teen prodigy, training at the world-renowned Nick Bollettieri Tennis Academy, we'd first take notice of her booming forehand, where as a 15-year-old, she'd advance to the fourth rounds of both the 2004 Australian Open and Wimbledon Championships. She'd continue her rise up the WTA rankings with a 2006 US Open quarterfinal appearance, defeating Agi Radwanska, Nadia Petrova, and Anna Chakvatadze, before a memorable showdown against fellow Bollettieri sensation Maria Sharapova. She would go on to beat Petrova again on the way to the biggest title of her career in Amelia Island. And in 2008, she would reach a career high ranking of 12 in the world before a back injury would ultimately sideline her for 11 years until her surprise announcement in 2019. And let's not forget her unbelievable run to the 2004 French Open mixed doubles title with Richard Gasquet. Today, she continues to stay close to the sport, working as a tennis commentator. And in this next hour, we'll reminisce and get to know how she was able to become one of the world's elite. Our guest this week is the fantastic Tatiana Golovin. Tatiana, welcome to Fantastic Tennis.
My goodness. Hi, John. Hi, Evan. Thank you so much for having me. I'm just so excited just hearing you with that intro. Oh, my goodness. Wow. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so grateful you're here today. I mean, you did all those things. I think it's going to be a very fun day today, especially for Emmett and I, because we get to see you. So this is going to be fun. Congrats on your work in BN Sports France. Unfortunately, my French is as weak as my second serve, so I have no idea what you're saying, but based on your reviews, everyone loves you. So congratulations. Well done.
Thank you so much. You watch the game and that's enough. No, don't always need to listen to every word.
Did it take time for you to be comfortable in the booth, or has your brain always been able to analyze and dissect tennis?
Oh, no, I think, or at least I hope I'm getting better with age and with time and with experience, because that is something I think that in the beginning you might be somewhat comfortable in front of the camera just because you're used to doing interviews, but actually talking and explaining tennis and kind of getting the, you know, what would the crowd want to hear? What do they want to know? It's something completely different. And no, so definitely in the beginning, it was not something that I was that comfortable with.
It's an art. It definitely is an art. We've had some great tennis commentators on the show. We've had Lindsay Davenport and Renee Stubbs and Pam Shriver and James Blake. They've all been great players turned pundits. I mean, it's a great skill. And they've all talked about the learning process about being on camera too. What's the best advice you've received so far working in TV?
Well, you know, I think every person is very different. It is important to kind of stay true to yourself and your personality and your character. So if you try to actually look or be like someone that you might actually like, but it's not really going to come out as nice. Like, I mean, I love what Jim Courier does when he does his on-court interviews. And I think that's even another scale because, you know, being in front of the camera in a booth or commentating the sport is one thing, but what he's able to do when he's out on the court and try to get that natural feel for the players, that's something, you know, fantastic. And I guess something you can't really learn. But for me, it was mostly taking my time because I do tend to speak too much and a lot and too fast.
That's good for today. For today, it's great.
Just answer one question. You don't have to go like a whole monologue by yourself. So that was kind of maybe one of the first advices that I got. But then, yeah, I think overall, it's just you have to stay true to who you are and be who you are because that's what people want.
Anything for the blooper reel yet? Have you had anything crazy happen on camera so far or so far so good?
I think we have a lot of bloopers in Paris. I think, you know, we a lot of the times, you know, I don't always understand all the French expressions because there's a lot of them. And, you know, we work with a little bit older people. So they always have these references to like older music or older actors and just older sayings in French. And I'm always kind of like, I don't know. I have no idea what you're saying. And this is all live, obviously. So you have no time for what's happening. But yeah, definitely in France, they have a ton.
You just nod a lot. You're just like, oh, yeah. Oh, he was great.
Then you just kind of agree and be like, okay, that's fine.
All right, let's cross our fingers. No bloopers today. All right, we'll see. Well, no promises, though. We have no idea. Today, it's just real talk. And I know a lot of your fans have a lot of feelings about your career. So I'd like to start the pod today the same way you started your service game while serving for the match during your 2005 upset win against legend Venus Williams in Charleston.
15 love.
And that's 15 love. It's a super simple game. I'm going to throw 15 questions at you, Tatiana, and you just respond as quickly as you can with the very first thing that pops into your voluntary brain. Okay, we ready? It could be tricky. Let's see. Number one, name the first professional match you remember watching live or on television.
I think Agassi, because my dad was obsessed with Agassi and he made me watch these Agassi attack and his backhand attack or whatever those. And I hated it. And we had like a really small TV and he just made me watch that all the time. It was the worst thing ever. But then actually I got to play with him. So that was really cool with him and Steffi. But I think probably one of his matches were the first ones that I saw.
Where did you play with Steffi and Andre?
Oh, I was really lucky because when I was working with Brad Gilbert, I was over at their house and she came over to hit with me. And she was actually one of my mentors on the WTA tour when they had like the godmother kind of program for the younger players. And and I got to hit with him as well. And unfortunately, it's weird because I was too young to actually really understand and fully acknowledge what I was doing. But definitely after I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I actually played with him.
Can you imagine, Emmett, Steffi Graf is your fairy godmother? She's my tennis fairy godmother. That's like a dream. Are you kidding? That is insane. That's great. All right. Question number two. Tatiana, congratulations. You welcomed your third child last year with husband and professional rugby player Hugo Bonneval. So really the question is this going to be a tennis playing family or a rugby playing family?
It's horrible. I have so much hope for my children. And I think the first two, I've kind of abandoned hope that, you know, they're going to do anything sports related. The little one, the third one, though, maybe I think he could actually do something positive in sports. But it's hard. It's really hard to see. I don't know if I have so much respect now for my parents. I mean, my dad was a professional hockey player and coach, but I don't know how my mom put up with me, you know, and all this training. And there's so much sacrifice that the parents have to do to get your kid into sports. I mean, obviously, they say, oh, they love it. They love it. But I kind of feel, I don't know if like all the kids really love sports that much. But yeah, definitely the first two, no, unfortunately not. I thought the genes were going to come into play, but they haven't so far.
Not yet. If you follow Tatiana on Instagram, you'll see your kids went golfing the other day. They look like pros. They were holding the bag pretty well.
Well, it's just because we're in Florida. I mean, there's nothing else to do except like you go golfing and the weather's nice and it's just being outside. And like I said, I wish I could go to the tennis court with them, but they're not so fun. They don't like it that much. So we're trying new sports, I guess.
Okay, good to know. So your eldest daughter, no rackets yet, no tennis, no interest.
No, she plays. They all play because I force them to play. But I know that's not the way to make it. You know, you don't force a kid at 6 years old to do anything. But she's definitely more into horses and crocodiles and reptiles and all that. The four-year-old is super strong. Like he's got like the really Russian kind of hockey build. But he's a little bit scaredy of like a lot of things. So I'm like, how are you going to be like a rugby player, a hockey player if you're like scared sometimes, you know, to get a little bit hurt?
Tennis. I was a scaredy cat and I played tennis. That was good. That was easier.
Yeah, but it's too much running for him. He doesn't like the running. So maybe golf, you know, he'll kind of by himself with the ball. Maybe that would work.
You have a lot on your hands. Definitely. Way more than this show. So this is going to be way easier than what you deal with in regular life. So we'll go on to question three.
This is great.
Speaking of your kids, Tatiana, they're probably still a bit young to understand just how great their mom was during her years on tour. But when the time comes, Tatiana, what will be the first match you show them on YouTube?
Oh, I showed them already. This is how I motivated for them to play tennis. I'm like, look what mommy did, because they always see me talking about tennis. They're like, you don't play tennis. You have makeup on and you're like wearing nice clothes. You're not a tennis player. So I had to show them, and I showed them, I usually show them Maria when I played against Maria in Miami when I go to the semis and I hurt myself. So there's like a little drama, and I usually show them that one, or maybe the match against Serena at the US Open as well.
Oh man, we're going to talk about those matches today. I love that you picked that one. That's a great one. All right. Number four, Emmett, actually this question's for you. I always say the relationship with tennis players and their fans is extremely special. So I wondered, what was it about Tatiana that made you such a big fan of hers during her career?
I'll say first, it was honestly the birthday thing. I mean, we were the exact same age and she was making the fourth round of the Australian Open at 15. And I was sitting there trying to study for math and thinking, oh God, I wish I were her. And, you know, it was just a marvelous thing to see. And then the next thing was that she could play on every surface. And that's what I always look for in a tennis player as a fan, is I want to see somebody who can do well on hard courts and grass and on clay. And she did that throughout her entire career. So it was just a great all-around type of player. And
right.
Honestly, the third bit is jealousy, because goodness, that forehand, I wish I had that forehand.
Oh, man. All right. Number five, Tatiana, no doubt you were a big fan favorite during your time on tour. So I wondered, what was your most memorable or strangest fan interaction that you had during your career? Besides today, of course.
No, I think, you know, I was pretty lucky. I've always had really great fans. I've always had really respectful fans as well. But, you know, you always have, especially I think it was in Asia, you have a lot of fans like at the hotel, and like they really follow you around. And even in France, and I got a lot of like really kind of touching letters, and they kind of always, you know, it kind of puts you into perspective, like how much influence you can have in someone's life. So I've been really blessed with like the fans. And even throughout now, when I came back when I tried to come back in 2019, I had so much support. And it was just kind of, you just feel so special. You know, I felt like I was 16 again, you know, kind of playing on the tour and having everyone behind me.
Oh, that's so amazing. I can't wait to talk about 2019 too. Number six, since we talked about fandom, can we talk about celebrity for a moment as well? Because nowadays, social media and how players deal with the constant pressure is a major topic in the sporting world. And during your time on tour, you had a big fan base and you were able to do some amazing things outside of tennis, like your epic 2009 Sports Illustrated. That was fantastic, by the way. A fan of yours, Mikhail Iganov, asks, with all the pressure that is put on athletes, do you feel you had too much outside pressure during your career to be more than just a tennis player?
Well, I think we can't compare. I think what social media has done in the past 10 years is just insane. Even the past 5 years, I feel we didn't feel that same pressure. We had pressure, yeah, maybe from magazine, from press, but everything was very controlled from with agents and your people around you. So like literally, if I only wanted to read something about myself, I had to either go buy a magazine, like the tennis magazine, or I had to go, or, you know, read the paper. Nothing was like on your phone like it is today. You're not as addicted to all the phone stories that you get, you know, right in your hand. So I think it was something positive. We wanted to get that attention. We wanted to be great tennis players, to be able to do things outside, to be able to travel, to be able to meet people, to be able to be on the covers of the magazine. So I think that was more source of motivation. I feel now, for sure, it's maybe not all positive. And I think it's a lot of, it definitely has a lot of negative influence on the players and the athletes and anyone who's kind of social out there. So I can't speak because I've never felt or lived what the players have to go through with today. And obviously it's a good thing because you can share with the fans so much, but I think it's got a really negative side also where, you know, you're still human and you still feel very attached to anything that's written about you. And when it's always there and like in your face, it's so hard to kind of cut it off and say, okay, I'm not going to look at it, because you still need to be in touch with your fans. So it's definitely a hard balance to find. And this is something new that the new generation is going to have to deal with.
For sure. I mean, I can't imagine being constantly scrutinized every match that you play. I mean, luckily we didn't grow up with Twitter and Instagram right during that era. So yeah.
In chat or something. This is what we had, or MSN chat. That was like,
exactly. Exactly. All right. Well, question number seven, this is kind of ties into what we're just talking about. We're going to discuss your comeback to the tour in 2019 in a little bit, but your fan in Toulouse, France, Marie Barbeau, writes in and asks, what did you find was the biggest change on tour from when you stopped playing in 2008 to 2019? Anything that you weren't a fan of?
I played two tournaments. So I didn't see that much. But I think one thing that shocked me for sure was the strength and the size of the players. When I was on tour, I was part of like the bigger girls, you know, because you had much smaller players that were on the top level. And now I just kind of felt, even when I walked through me, when I looked and commentated Joanna Konta, she always kind of looked kind of normal size to me, but she was so tall. But you're supposed to be like kind of normal. And I felt really small compared to her. So I think there's just, now that the athletes, they're just much stronger, much taller. They're obviously fitter because, you know, they're able to play much longer. So I think the physical aspect definitely evolved compared to when I played, where, you know, we had players with like Justine and Kleist just looked like, you know, she was one of the stronger players, but actually now she's completely regular, normal compared to the girls that are on tour.
Fascinating. Absolutely. Gosh, the evolution from Martina to Steffi to Serena. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy. You're absolutely right. Well, question number 9, as an amazing commentator, you've now experienced all sides of analyzing the game. So I wondered, in your opinion, what's been your favorite match you've commentated thus far?
This is a tricky one.
I know. You're about to piss somebody off, Tatiana. I heard you on that podcast and you didn't even say me.
Well, no, because actually we commentate a lot of the times. So in Europe, we do tournaments in the US, so we're jet lagged. So like commenting at 3 a.m. So hold on, I need to get my mind. Oh, I thought Muguruza against Osaka. I guess beginning of the year.
In Australia.
Yeah. And she had that match with her. And I was watching her. I'm like, ooh, this is such an amazing beginning of the year for Muguruza. She's going to do so well. And then, you know, it didn't happen, didn't go her way. But definitely, I think the matches with when you're watching, you know, Osaka and Serena, just when you get the big names out there, because obviously, I've always said it, women's tennis to me is getting better every year. But just the problem is that sometimes we don't always know the players because they're not able to be as stable throughout the year. So when you get those big names out there in the finals, it just makes it that much more exciting to follow and watch and to commentate and to kind of talk about it. So I'd have to say some of the Osaka against Serena matches, because that's just kind of like the change of the generations. And I mean, there's just always so much drama. So it's always so fun and interesting to watch.
I love it. Emmett, that's twice you said drama. I'm getting a profile of Tatiana tonight. I'm kind of figuring out what her personality is. I love it. All right. Number 9, speaking of commentating, if you ever need a second job commentating for another sport, you can always try figure skating. As your fans know, that you epically appeared on a reality TV show in France, The Ice Show, back in 2013. Tell me everything. Start right now. I saw some clips. It looks so amazing. I could barely balance on a New York City subway. And I saw you doing flips and like, you know, you're twisting. No, tell me everything.
I'm obsessed with that. I was so happy they called me to do the show. You know, it's really traditional in culture in Russia. So like my mom watches every winter, she watches the Russian TV and they just make a huge show out of ice skating with celebrities and professionals. And they actually use like all Olympic winners to be on their show. So when they did the show in France, I was so happy to be on it. And like I said, I have that from childhood where my dad was a hockey coach. So I actually, before I played tennis, I used to kind of ice skate when I was like 3-4 years old before going to school. I would help him prepare and set like his practice with his team before he would drop me off to school. So I would kind of be there always on the ice. So just to be able to be with Olympic champions that I watched at the Olympics with Gwendal Pezra, Surya Bodanli, who's here in the States, Philippe Candelero was just amazing. It was a dream come true. And I had the best couple months of my life doing that.
You killed it. You got to the finals. You were like a pro.
Yeah, I broke my elbow like in the second week of when we were practicing. I fell and I actually had a cast throughout the whole show. So I was actually ice skating with like one arm.
Because you're a warrior. That's why. A warrior. That's what you do. You're a boss.
I feel like I'm not giving up. I have the apprentice or not. I'm not giving up because they didn't want to put me back on the ice with like insurance issues and all that. I'm like, I don't care. I'm going. This is on me. I want to do it. You're not taking me out of the show.
Oh my gosh. Any other hidden talents? I mean, where are we going to see you next? What reality TV show? The Voice, Survivor, Dancing with the Stars?
Oh no, no singing. No, I would do Dancing with the Stars as well. I mean, that would be a fun experience, but you know, definitely ice skating was something that was on top of. What else do I have? Definitely not cooking. I'm not great at cooking, but I mean, that's something you could learn. I could babysit. I've become a really good nanny. I could be that.
A celebrity. You could babysit like old tennis players. How about that?
Oh,
well, I would watch that show. And you could just like, I don't know, maybe you put, or maybe it's like a big brother house with all tennis players. And that you and Richard, yeah, we'll put Gasquet in there with you. We'll do
sure.
Steffi and Andre, you know, it'll be a fun show.
Maybe that's a good idea. Maybe somebody will hear us and actually get that as an idea. I'm sure a lot of the players would like to do that.
Who else would be dramatic that we need in the house? I don't know. We'd have to see.
Mofis and Svitolina.
Oh, they have to be in the house. They have to. And Flavia, you can bring all your kids. Yeah. You will have like a kid room
exactly.
with you and Fabio. Yeah, we'll do. This is writing itself, you guys. This is too easy. All right. Well, I'll come back to it. We'll figure it out. Number 11, you proudly represented France throughout your career and have lots of great wins in team competitions. Your fan in Prague, Czech Republic, Martin Svoboda, asks, what is your favorite Hopman Cup or Fed Cup memory?
I had a lot of great, I mean, I love playing at Fed Cup. I think this is, my dad always told me that I'm not a team player. And that's true. I hate sharing the victories and, or, you know, kind of being responsible that somebody else is responsible for my defeat. I hate that. But definitely playing for Fed Cup was like one of the best experiences, just being with the team, being together, playing in front of the fans for your country. And we have such a great team in France. I think maybe... Well, the most special was obviously going to Russia. That was my first time actually back in Russia since we left. So that was special to be discovering basically my birthplace with the French team.
Yeah.
And I remember always Tarpishev and all the girls like, oh, you should be playing with us. You should be playing in our team as well. And actually when we, so this was like my first year. And I think you have to, there's like a ritual where you have to kind of go and invite all of your team and you have to make a speech when it's your first, when you're picked for the first time to play for a country. So I said, okay, we'll do it when we're in Russia in Moscow. So I brought him to Cafe Pushkin, which was like a big Russian restaurant, and everybody was like drinking vodka, which was after, obviously, when we played. But definitely we had a great kind of true Russian culture experience with that. And Hopman Cup was just so fun because beginning of the year, just starting out nicely in the sun, great atmosphere, and just none of that pressure or stress of like completely winning. Like you wanted to win, but at the same time, you kind of enjoy the players and enjoy that whole atmosphere and getting ready for the Australian Open. So I think I played with Arnaud Clément, but I don't remember who I played with the first time.
A couple times. Yeah. They were names. I don't know. You were the star of the team for sure. When I looked, I was like, oh, I don't remember him so much. So. All right. Number 12, you get one singles loss from your career to turn into a win instead. Which do you pick? And it can't be your US Open quarterfinal.
Against Maria?
Yeah.
You know who? I know who. Hated losing. It was horrible.
Tell me.
At the French Open against Elena Bovina.
Okay.
It was Bovina. I think it was like in the third or fourth round. And it was, I always didn't play that well. But that year I was kind of better at the French Open. And I lost, I think, against Bovina. It was horrible.
She was a good player. She got...
And then Kukalova. Did I get two matches?
Yeah. Give me two.
Kukalova. It was like...
the Kukalova match?
Kukalova, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Kukalova. Yeah, that was 2004. Kukalova.
We got stopped at night because of the darkness. And we had to come back the next day, and it was awful. Everything was awful. Yeah, definitely those two matches at the French Open I would take back.
I don't think so. I think you're missing one for sure. There's one. I mean, come on. You lost in the finals of Stuttgart. And do you know what happens when you win in Stuttgart?
Oh, for the
Porsche.
You know how much I negotiated with the guys? I'm like, I made two finals. I deserve a Porsche, right? I mean,
Exactly. Screw the French Open third round against Bovina. You want the Porsche, Tatiana. Hello, you could pass that on to your daughter.
Yeah, but it was good tennis. Like, you know, they played well.
All right.
You know, it was a good match. I was already in the finals. It was a good tournament for me. But that the French Open hurts being in Paris and losing so badly in front of your crowd.
All right, fair. I get it. I was going to say you're wrong. Like you're wrong for your own decision of who you pick. And I'm like, no, you're wrong, Tatiana. That's not the match you would pick.
No, I agree with you. But they had a really good chocolate fountain in Stuttgart. So I kind of, you know, felt better after my loss with the chocolate fountain.
We're winding down here in this round. Number 13, from your memory, was there a player on tour whose game just did not match up well against yours? Anyone whose name you saw on the draw and you just said, oh, not her.
Any girl who like, basically, his game was just to hit as hard as they could. I hated that.
Really?
Kind of exactly what happened when I came back in 2019 in Poitiers and I played this German player, which I don't remember the name, unfortunately.
Lautner, yes. Okay.
Yeah. And basically, it's like, okay, so she serves and she hits. It goes in, it goes out. It goes like, okay, so how do you play tennis with that? You're just basically waiting on your opponent. And this is kind of like what Maria did, Sharapova, how she played. So this is kind of, you know, how Serena, even though Serena can really kind of mix it a bit more. But that's why I had much more wins against players who were top ranked, but maybe more like Petrova or Kuznetsova, who didn't play like 1-2 tennis. So any one of those players, even if they weren't as highly ranked, but they just had like a game where they just hit the ball all over the place, I didn't like that.
Okay, there we go. Number 14, we get to talk about your amazing mixed doubles run to the French in a little bit, but I wondered, who would you have loved to have played doubles or mixed with during your career that you never got the chance to?
Well, girls, I don't care, but I mean, I would have loved to play with Rafa.
Rafa. Oh, good. I'm so glad, Rafa. Most people say Roger. I was like, oh.
No.
Rafa fan. We got a Rafa fan. Okay. I love it. All right. Well, last question in this round. Tatiana, we're going to talk a lot today about the things you were able to accomplish on the tennis court. But I wondered, what do you want the tennis world to remember you for?
It's hard to say because I feel like I haven't played enough. And I feel like there's so much more I should have probably accomplished or kind of, I should have played much longer. So it's hard to say. But I guess, yeah, I didn't realize at the time that I was my forehand was compared to maybe even Steffi's forehand. So I do hope that people remember me for that shot.
Hey, fantastic fans. I have to tell you about the most amazing tennis experience I just had this past weekend at the Strand Tennis Center. I've been so hungry to get back on the court, and my best friend Jake invited me to his new club in Chatham, New Jersey, just 35 minutes from where I live in New York City, and I had an out-of-body tennis experience at this clinic. First, the club is impeccable, and I was greeted with free coffee, so, you know, they had me as soon as I walked through the door. The Strand has pickleball, cardio tennis, junior play, league play, you name it, and the owner, Stephen Capo, helped organize the most fun clinic. I had the best time that I've had on a court in as long as I can remember. It was so fun and so competitive. You've got to check out the Strand Tennis Center. Visit their website, www.strandtc.com, or their social media on Instagram and Twitter at Strand Tennis to get more information for your next hit. Their motto is sweat, learn, fun, and you're going to walk away doing all three at the Strand Tennis Center. We're ready for a game, guys. Are we ready for a game today? Let's talk about Tatiana's career. I'd love to play a game called I 40 Love You. It's gonna be Emmett versus Tatiana in a fan versus favorite tennis match trivia showdown all about Tatiana's career and life. Emmett, I'm gonna ask you two questions about Tatiana's career. And then Tatiana, I'm gonna ask you two questions that test your own memory about your own career. If we happen to end up in a 2-2 tie, I've hidden a fun tiebreak question a bit later in the game just for you, Tatiana. And you never want to lose a tiebreak, right? No.
No. I mean, no.
That US Open quarterfinal, 6-6. That was a Sharapova loss. 6-6. You know, let's not talk about tiebreaks. All right, let's go to question one. This first round is for you, Tatiana. Let's start us off. Tatiana, we're going to go all the way back to your early days on the Junior ITF Tour to start us out today. So here's your first question. I personally love a comeback. And your 2019 comeback announcement had the tennis world's ears perked up, as did the announcement that this former doubles number one would be making her comeback to the doubles court in 2020 after more than 2 years away from the game. And just a hint, you also happened to beat her at
Vesnina
at Junior Wimbledon. Did you beat Vesnina at Junior Wimbledon? Yeah, did not. There's your hint. Which former doubles number one still playing today did you beat at Junior Wimbledon?
Oh, Mirza. But I didn't know. I didn't beat it. Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
You're okay. Oh my God, this is stressful.
I love it. She's so like, you're so impatient. I love that so much. I love you so much more now. You're like, shut up. It's Miss Nina. Oh, you'll regret that. But I'll give it to you. You get Mirza. Okay. The tennis world loves a comeback. Obviously, Tatiana and Hingis and Clijsters and of course, Golovin. I mean, that's amazing. But before every fun comeback is the first coming. So I'd love to talk about how you got your starts in this crazy sport. Tatiana, who put a racket in your hands as a kid?
My dad.
Yeah. Why? Why tennis?
Well, yeah, just my dad is a huge tennis fan. You know, I don't know why, up until today, he loves that he watches the videos again and he like works on his forehand, but he's like, you know, whatever, 70 something years old, but he still goes out on the court and tries to work on that technique. And he tries to be exactly like Roger, by the way. But yeah, just from, I guess, my dad's passion got me into it. And then I have to say my mom definitely lived with me throughout my whole career and traveled with me. And I owe her so much, for sure.
You were obviously a natural talent as a kid as you move to the world famous Nick Bollettieri Tennis Academy in Bradenton, Florida. How old were you when you first started working with Nick?
Well, it's a funny story. He actually wrote, if you read, I think it was his book, My Aces, My Faults. I think that was his book. And there's actually a little passage about me there at the US Open where he's like, oh, a lady kind of comes and taps me on my shoulder at the US Open in 96, I guess, or 95, I'm not sure. And she's like, oh, this is going to be the next star. And a week later, it was me at the academy on a scholarship for 8 years. I met him at a clinic at the US Open. You know, he was doing those kids clinics during the Open. And my parents kind of pushed me like, go play in front of him. And he's like, okay, I'll invite you for a week at the academy. And I ended up staying for 8 years. So again, my mom's kind of initiative to go and I guess be brave and not be scared to say, you know, have a look at my daughter. And I was 7 years old.
And that changed your life.
That changed my life. Absolutely. My whole family moved there. And Maria was there. She was 8 and she was already there for a year. And, you know, I think that was something really important to have someone also there your age, even though it was only maybe the two of us, but at least it was somebody else kind of like me, because in an individual sport, if you're not like in the right surroundings, it's so difficult. So definitely the academy brought me so much, and it's changed a lot now. Obviously now it's IMG Academies and it's a great place, but it's got a very different feel from how it was 20 years, 25 years ago.
What was it like 20 years ago? What was Bollettieri like? Was it a competitive place?
It was much smaller.
Was it competitive? Was it supportive?
It was much smaller. So I think it was more like a big family. Everybody knew each other. Everybody kind of helped each other. And everybody was there on the same goal as to become, you know, the best tennis player. So it was like a little bit like an army and everything was really strict. And it was just like new and it was exciting. And at the same, they made it fun. That was very important, I think, to keep things fun. It was nice weather. On Friday afternoons, we had music on the tennis court. So that was really motivating. And, you know, a lot of game playing. And now, obviously, as a mother, I realize how important that is for kids, because working hard is important. But at some point, it has to be a game as well for them to keep wanting to go back. And in the long run, that's really important.
Yeah. Yeah. You need the interest. You were a great junior. You got to 6th in the world on the ITF junior rankings. And you made the semis of junior Wimbledon and junior US Open. And you were great enough to turn pro at a very early age. A fan of yours, Williams Ohanian from Tennis Forum, asks, did you feel pressure from the French Tennis Federation to turn pro at such a young age? And looking back, would you have considered staying juniors a little longer?
Oh, no, absolutely no. No to both questions. No pressure. And no, I did not want to stay in juniors. And I think I just couldn't wait until I could get a pro. And I was so grateful to get that wild card. And no, actually, I think I don't know if I really understood pressure at that time. I think I felt more pressure playing juniors, where you kind of felt like you had to win because, you know, it was kind of time and, you know, you wanted to do well really quickly. So, no, I don't think I felt the pressure. You felt the pressure maybe the second year on tour because you have to like kind of defend all your points and, you know, you're not new anymore. But no, the Federation always was extremely helpful in helping with coaches and the practices. So, yeah. No, only good things.
You started playing ITF events in 2002 at 14 years old, and you played in French Open qualifying that same year. What do you remember from that first French Open experience?
Not a lot.
Yeah.
Right?
That's okay. I mean, it's a long time. I mean, for sure.
No, I mean, not a lot. Like, I didn't play much there. I remember, I think there's a photo of me, but I don't think I understood I was playing Roland Garros.
Yeah.
I think I was... Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I remember that little like Lacoste skirt. I think a lot of the things that, I mean, when you do when you're that young is you just kind of follow the flow and you don't really know what you're doing. You just know that, you know, you have to practice and you have to play and you're in this amazing place and you kind of give it your all, but you don't fully acknowledge and realize what's really happening to you. So definitely I can't say that I have a lot of memories from that particular French Open. I remember I maybe got to the semis of like Wimbledon or the US Open juniors because I was still playing juniors at the time. So I think I have more like established memories of juniors playing at that time rather than actually the qualies of the French.
Well, who knew just 2 years later after playing qualifying, you'd end up a French Open champion in just 2 short years. So let's go to question two, and it's for you, Emmett. And it's about Tatiana's time on the doubles court. Here's your question. Emmett, we all know Tatiana famously won the 2004 mixed doubles title with Richard Gasquet. Why am I struggling with Richard's name tonight? I'm not even through a whole glass. Sorry, Richard. Richard Gasquet. All right.
Richard.
But do you know, Emmett, here we go. Let's try this again. Emmett, we all know Tatiana famously won the 2004 mixed title with Richard Gasquet, but do you know which ladies Grand Slam singles champion from France that Tatiana made her main draw doubles debut with a wild card at the 2002 French Open.
It's a French Grand Slam champion?
I don't even think Tatiana knows at this point. French singles Grand Slam champion.
Marion Bartoli?
Yes, oui! You're on the board. Congratulations, Emmett. Yes.
There we go.
Tatiana, you definitely picked good partners. I mean, you played with Marion and Richard and
yep.
Hingis and Pierce. You played doubles with Dinara Safina. So many greats. You didn't play a ton of doubles, but when you did, you picked good partners. So they're good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Good friends, I guess.
Can we talk about your 2004 tennis season? Because this is really where you started shooting up the rankings. By 2003, you'd already won your first WTA main draw match in Indian Wells, and your ranking was quickly moving up. And by the start of the 2004 season, you were ready to beat the best in the world. You started the year at the Australian Open ranked 354 in the world, and you defeated two top 25 players to make the fourth round, where you'd play American Lisa Raymond. It was a huge result for you, and it put you on tennis radars for the first time. What do you remember from the 2004 Australian Open?
That horrible defeat. That was awful. I played so bad. I was so intimidated by the court.
Yeah.
It was the first time. And I think we like barely even got to practice on it right before. And I had no experience whatsoever. What do I remember? I remember I lost weight. I lost weight, actually. And I think that was really important because it was so hot out there. And we used to go running every morning with Pierre Chéret, my coach. And we had the same routine. And we used to go running before breakfast. And then we used to have breakfast. And then we used to practice in the same courts and kind of have the same ritual. And I think that really helped me kind of stay in the moment. And then it was my birthday the day before the match. And then, like I said, I got a little bit overwhelmed by playing Lisa and just playing on center court. So yeah, it was like you said, it was the first thing that got me on the radar.
Yeah.
It got me going.
But you kept going after that. Let's talk about it. After your splash in Melbourne, you'd play at the Paris indoor event, getting the biggest win of your career at that point. You'd beat your first top 10 player, Elena Dementieva. What a great match. Fantastic. You then beat Safina and Yankovic in Miami, and the wins kept coming at that point. How was it that things were starting to click for you so quickly? It seemed like overnight, you go from the year before in the Australian Open, and now you're beating all these top players. You're now playing like a top 20 player. What do you think it was that was clicking so quickly for you?
Yeah, I think I felt like this is where, in some ways, I belonged. Like, this is where I should be, how I should be playing. And like you said, there was something that kind of clicked in your head, in your tennis, where you're like, okay, this is what I need to do. I'm understanding my tennis. I know what I'm supposed to do. I know how I'm supposed to play. I also think that the players on the other side did not know how to play me at all because I was so new and they didn't really know who I was. So I think it was more difficult for them. I was playing with no pressure whatsoever. I was just kind of all on my high, on my confidence and all of that. So it was much easier for me that first year, just kind of discovering everything and playing with absolutely no pressure against the top players who them were exactly the opposite sensation when they're playing against me. But I think it was also all the hard work that was put in throughout the years that were finally paying off. So I just felt kind of normal and natural that this is what was going to happen.
You'd next move on to the red clay at the French Open. And after a loss to veteran Clara Kukulova,
Oh, yeah. See, there you go. There she is.
In the first round, you stuck around and you entered the mixed event with Richard Gasquet. It was the first time you'd play with Richard, and it would prove to be lucky because you'd end up winning a Grand Slam title. I mean, what a fun run that was. It was crazy. What a crazy, unexpected run. What fun memories do you have from that title run with Richard?
Well, you know, we both lost in the first round and we actually didn't really know each other before playing together. And I think we literally asked at the last minute to get a wild card. Like, it was not planned at all. It was literally just to get kind of, okay, we're two French young players and we lost already before the tournament, like barely started. Like, we have to do something. So I think they gave us the wild card and we had no expectations. And then we just kind of realized like, hey, maybe we're not that bad. Like, I think like in the second round, we already beat like a really good pair.
The second seed, yeah.
The second seed, yeah. And so we're like, okay, well, if we beat them, now we just got to go all the way. And then it just really helped us through Wimbledon because I think we both played well at Wimbledon after that. So just that whole experience, that was one of the best moments playing on center court and lifting up the trophy and just being so young, both of us. And we're like, yeah, we're like the only two French players to have played together and actually win in France. So that was super special.
Do you remember that match point? Was it something that was just like...
Yeah, I was like, I'm not hitting the overhead. You hit it. You take it. You do it. I don't care. That's maybe like the first time I actually was like, I don't want to be responsible for what happens. You take all the responsibility. I'm like, I'm not messing this up.
Did things start getting crazy for you after the French Open? Were you feeling the spotlight at this point, or did it maybe come a little bit later after your great Wimbledon run?
No, I think I didn't even enjoy the win, because literally the day after, like, we finished maybe around 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening, and we were already looking to leave to England the following morning, and we were already late to go play Birmingham. So we had no time to enjoy, and it was just going back to practice and adjusting to this new grass that I've never played on.
But did you feel pressure from the media at that point? Obviously, you're a new French Open champion. You're young, both of you. I mean, did you start to feel the media at all, kind of asking for more interviews, asking more attention? Did you feel pressure at all as a player?
But it was good pressure. I think it was something like, oh wow, this is so cool because we won, and look what it's getting us when we play good tennis. Mm-hmm. Look what we're getting. So I think it was all like really positive things. And like I said, I think we were protected well enough by the people around us from all that negativity, that it was just all positive. And even the media, but it was all positive. Mm-hmm. It was only getting good emotions from the press, and just, it was more motivating than anything else.
Interesting. Well, after the French, you'd play your first grass court tournament, as you just said. You'd made the finals in Birmingham, losing to Maria Sharapova. And from there, you'd continue your good form on grass, and you'd make the fourth round of Wimbledon, running into the GOAT, Serena Williams. It was your very first Wimbledon. You're playing Serena Williams for a spot in the quarterfinals. What a moment. I mean, that's like a dream of every tennis player, right?
I had, so Andy Roddick was working with Brad Gilbert at the time. And so Brad, you know, was kind of helping me out also whenever he had a little bit of time. And I remember before I went onto the match against Serena, Andy slipped like a little note saying, you know, just wishing me luck and saying to play well and to go out there and, you know, not to be scared. And, you know, I just felt like, wow, I'm like going to be the princess, and then Prince William is going to hear about me, and I'm going to be in the news. And I just thought it was all like a fairy tale for me, except obviously the end result, losing really badly to Serena. But
okay,
just,
well, yeah,
it's so magical playing at Wimbledon. And again, being really young and experiencing this for the first time, you just really felt really, truly special when you're in that stadium and in that arena.
Were you nervous? I mean, did you curtsy? Was it, I mean, what are the feelings?
And we had to curtsy, that's right. We had not to forget to curtsy, because we still had to curtsy back in those days, and just walking. And you know, you had like those different lockers also for like the top players and then the rest of the players. So that was always like, okay, we have to play well to get to those lockers. And then Brad would always be like, oh, and you need to absolutely, you know, do well so you can go to the dance at the end of the tournament. So it was kind of like all of these extra things that had nothing to do with tennis. But when you're 16 years old, like this is what you think about and what you think is super cool.
Oh man. Yeah, absolutely. This is a good mind frame. We're like back into the zone of like a 16-year-old. This is so fun today. Well, Tatiana, you started 2004 at 345 in the world, and you'd finish 2004 at 27 in the world. That is a remarkable stat. At this point, you're a Grand Slam champion, but there was a lot more success right around the corner. So let's go to question three and talk about your amazing 2006 US Open run. And then we're going to stick with you. This is your last question today. Okay, you ready?
I'm ready.
In 2006, Tatiana would make her first Grand Slam quarterfinal appearance at the US Open. In the third round, she would defeat this former top five Russian that she would lose to just once in her career. Her only loss would be just two events later, where she would defeat Tatiana in the finals of the Porsche Grand Prix in Stuttgart. Who stole a Porsche away from Tatiana Golovin?
I think it's Nadia Petrova.
Do you know that, Tatiana? Is that true?
Yeah, I think so.
Yes. Nadia stole a Porsche from Tatiana Golovin. Put that in the headline.
Yeah, but Henin had a lot of them. She could have also shared with me.
I mean, Henin would have been in the, I mean, Petrova, top five. I mean, I love it. But beating Justine would have been fantastic too. That's a good one, right? But any of them.
Yeah.
Take a Porsche wherever you can get a Porsche, right? That's what I said.
True. And they're just like standing there looking at you. So you're kind of like, ugh, come to me.
Yeah, look at my Porsche. Would you trade that US Open third round for a Porsche or no?
No, but I know you really want badly a Porsche. So I know what present to get you. This is like, you're obsessed with the Porsche. So we'll get you. I don't want the Porsche. I want the French Open win, and I want the US Open win. I don't want the Porsche.
I've just never been. You've been close twice to a Porsche. I mean, you're as close as I've been to a Porsche, and we're on Zoom right now. So that's as close as I've gotten to my Porsche. All right. Well, after 2004, you'd continue to move up the rankings, and you'd crack the top 20 for the first time in 2005. In 2006, you'd have another solid season as well. And it would also be the year where you'd have one of the most talked about and controversial matches of the year. Your 2006 Miami Open semifinal match versus Maria Sharapova had everything tennis fans love. It was high caliber. It was oh so much drama. I had several fans like Mitch Adams in Austin, Texas, USA, write in and ask, how do you feel about that particular match all these years later? And just as a refresher before you answer, Tatiana overcame a 5-1 deficit and 4 match points while being down in the second set. And then you push the match to a third set before spraining your ankle and having to leave the court and head to the hospital.
Yeah, it was one of the worst pains of my life, I think, spraining my ankle there. It was quite bad.
And like, you went through labor 3 times. So Maria owes you a very nice present.
Oh yeah, it's true. I shouldn't say that. Yeah, no, nothing is compared to labor. I shouldn't say that. But no, but like when you look at the images and like you see like the side of my, I don't know how you call it, like the ankle like touched the ground, and it's definitely very freaky.
Well, Maria was booed. I mean, if you remember, yeah, she took a bathroom break up 5-4 in the second after, and then again, another one at 5-1 up, and she took another bathroom break. How do you feel about, I mean, obviously looking back, a lot of people talk about this match, and I'm sure you've been asked about this match a lot. And at the time, a lot of people tried to make this a big deal and they pit you versus Maria, and knowing your history with being friends at Bollettieri, I'm sure that was quite uncomfortable too. But did you feel a certain way? Did you have to talk to her after the match? Did you feel like there was maybe gamesmanship at any point?
Well, I mean, I think, well, we've known each other so much, but I think just from, in some ways that showed that she was worried and that she was fearful also of me. So in some ways I didn't take it personally at all for me. I mean, like I said, we've known each other since we were 7 years old, and this was just her competing. This is how she dealt with, you know, adversity. This is how much she wanted to win. And this is just part of her character. And for me, this was, you know, this is the way I fought as well. But, it was understandable that, you know, the people wanted to have, you know, the show continue. And it was, you know, like an extremely interesting match. And when there's a comeback, it always makes it that much more fun. And just being at the Miami crowd, and I was actually living in Miami at the time. So like I was staying at home when I went to the tournament, which, you know, made it that much more special. So yeah, night session.
Good match.
Kind of could compare to some of the US Open finals or US Open matches, night matches.
Maria aside, did you feel like a lot of players took advantage of maybe rules during your playing days? Was that as egregious as it was maybe, you know, we're talking about someone like Andy Murray, you're commentating now, and Andy Murray blasted Stefano Tsitsipas this past year for taking bathroom breaks. Do you feel this is a more normal part of the game, or was this also happening when you were playing as well?
Well, it's more new, I guess, in the men's now. It was quite common always with the girls because it does take longer to go and change. And yes, girls don't always go and change. It's more to break the rhythm. And but sometimes it's just so hard when you're on the court. And I don't know if I took a lot of bathroom breaks, but I mean, there are moments where you're like, I can't be on this court anymore. I can't regroup here. I need to kind of take a step away. And it doesn't always help. I mean, sometimes it could break the rhythm from your opponent, but if you're in a bad state of mind, it's not going to the bathroom for 5 minutes that's going to change anything. But it's hard to say. I think that's also part being a professional, that you need to deal with rains, bathroom breaks, umpires, the crowd. I mean, there's so many things you need to deal with. Tennis match is not perfect. That's what makes tennis such a hard and difficult sport, is because it's not just the physical or the technique. It has to be, it's everything. You need to be perfect in absolutely everything in order to make it.
Well, you were almost perfect in your 2006 quarterfinal run to the US Open. Let's talk about that. You played Maria Sharapova once again in a big match. It was a very tight 6-6 match. What do you remember from your 2006 quarterfinal US Open run?
You know, I think I've never said this, but this is like a special interview as well. This is the time where I stopped because I have blisters on my feet, no?
Yes.
I think. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I think it's horrible because I got a pedicure the day before, and I will never, ever have a pedicure because basically it took, I guess I wasn't thinking. And I blame my mom for not preparing me better for this either, because basically I took away all the calluses. So when I had to go and play after an hour match, my feet were bleeding and I couldn't move. But yeah, again, I think that was a great, it was a much better match because I've always lost really badly to Maria, except maybe that semifinals in Miami. The other times I was always blown away of the court. So for me to be able to play that well and to have that belief that I could do well against her in such a big important match, definitely in my mind showed me that I can be even better.
By 2006, are you feeling like you're a top player? Are you gunning for Grand Slams? Was that your goal? Was it to be top 10? Was it to be number one? Was it to win a Grand Slam? Because the progress that you had in your career, I know you're a young player at this point. We're talking about you're 18 at this point. But are you feeling like, okay, I can do this? Like I'm on the great projection here.
Well, I think it comes with tournaments. And I think I've never had, maybe not looking, thinking back, I've never had the ambition when I was really like little to be like, oh, I'm going to be number one or I'm going to win a Grand Slam. For me, it was kind of looking up to those players and trying to be like them and wanting to be like them. But it was never like, I'm going to win a Grand Slam or I'm going to be number one. Like to me, that was way too far. like too far up for me. So the more I played, the more I played against the better players, the more I realized I can do this. I can be better, which is why I regret not playing longer, because I feel like I did learn so much every year and that my ambitions became higher the more I played and the better I got.
Do you consider that US Open match the most important match of your career?
I think there were, it was one of the nicer ones, obviously. Yeah. It was the ones where you kind of like, okay, I like coming to a tournament and no, not that many people are here, but you're kind of feel special in the locker rooms and, you know, everybody looks at you differently. So you have a different status. But I think I've learned more from my loss in the first round, maybe at the US Open the following year. And then I go on to win Porto Rose. And yeah, just because you kind of really question yourself, like, okay, I haven't been winning a lot. Like, what do I need to do to change? And I think you learn more from those type of difficult moments. When I was training with Mats Wilander and like, I literally didn't win any matches when I was working with him. And then I ended up winning everything as soon as we stopped working together. But that didn't mean because it was of him. I think I've learned so much from him. I just wasn't able to put it in place with him, but then I did it after. So it's a process. It's hard to say what... you know, what tournament, what match gives you the right feeling. But definitely for me, it was more the bad experiences that made me be much better afterwards.
Oh, I love it. Well, speaking of happy times, let's go on to our last question today. And it's about a very happy memory, your first WTA singles title. So Tatiana, this is your last question. And he has two, you have one. You have to tie this up today. Here we go. Let's do this.
Okay.
On the way to the biggest title of your career, you need to defeat three future Grand Slam champions in a row to do it. Sam Stosur, Venus Williams, and Anna Ivanovic, before defeating Nadia Petrova in the finals to win your very first title in Amelia Island. But can you remember the name of your opponent that you defeated in the first round of that tournament? I mean, after you said you didn't know you played this past year, I was like, oh no, this could be a hard one.
Yeah,
it's okay. Some people don't remember. Like, it's not a thing. It's fine. It's okay.
I'm horrible. No, like, this is like a real problem for me. I think I have like, I think memory issues. I don't remember anything.
You worry about more important things. You worry about a play date on Wednesday.
I sometimes even forget my own children. No, I forget everything. Hold on. Oh no, I don't think I can remember. Sorry.
She got to 35 in the world in 2006. It's all right. If you don't know, you don't know. It's just it.
I don't. Does that mean I lose?
But you lose to Emmett though. So it's not bad. It's not a bad thing.
Okay. Well, does Emmett know?
Emmett, do you know?
I have Gisela Dulko in my head, but I think she got higher ranked than that.
You know what though? I'm very impressed because you're in the same continent.
As a South American player?
Does that give you a hint? Anybody?
Amelia Island 2007.
Yeah. Got to 35. Oh my gosh. I'll just end this misery. It's fine. Catalina Castaño. I know. It's not like a name we're going to hear all the time. I know. I didn't know you, Tatiana. I thought maybe you would have a better memory than that.
I'm not Federer. Federer like remembers all his matches. Definitely. No.
I mean, Pam Shriver can remember matches from when she's a like a savant.
Yeah.
That's crazy. All right. Let's wrap up today because we're in happy times. I know we lost the game, but let's talk about you winning your first title.
Not so happy anymore.
2007 was such a great season for you. You were playing some great tennis at the start of the year. And then you get to Amelia Island and you take it up a notch and you defeat some legendary names. What do you remember from that Amelia Island tournament? I mean, you're holding up a trophy, a singles trophy, after years on tour right now at this point, and you beat some of the best players in the world. I mean, Venus Williams, Anna Ivanovic, these are legendary Hall of Fame names. So what do you remember from that clay court win?
Well, again, I remember the whole process about getting there. I don't play well in Miami. I don't defend my points from the year before. And actually, I have to give credit to that for that tournament to Louis Courtois, because this was the week before the Fed Cup. So I think like the whole French team was kind of there. Mm. And he said, he's like, okay, let me help you get ready for this tournament. And then it's going to help us anyways for Fed Cup. So it's a win-win situation. And he worked with me every morning and we worked on my back end because my back end was really my weak spot. And we just found a rhythm with my back end for the ball to go in the court. And I think I could trust my forehand. My serve was good. And now the back end was in a good week. And then it happened. And then just, again, that work that we put in with Loic during those during that week.
Just made it happen.
Happened.
Do you have a match where you feel like you played the best? I mean, looking back, I know we don't really ruminate about too much about tennis, but was there, I mean, obviously that week is such a bright spot, but was that the best tennis you ended up playing in one week?
I think so. For sure. I think so. And especially it being on clay court, which was, I know Emmett says like I'm an all court kind of player, but I mean, I do prefer, I guess, the indoors where there's no sun, no wind, where the court is like not too fast, not too slow, where it's perfect conditions. So definitely like playing well for the first time on clay was like very, very important. Mm-hmm. I didn't, even though it's green clay, so it's a little different. It was a bit mm-hmm. faster than the red. But yeah, just having that consistency of playing that well and just feeling like you're in the zone, like nothing at that point, no one or nothing could get me off track. And that's just something that you rarely feel as an athlete. That's exactly what you look for every single time. So I think that was definitely, I think it would have been a week of a Grand Slam. I could have probably gone really, really far as well.
Absolutely.
Cheers to you, Tatiana. Cheers to you.
Yay.
Do you remember how you celebrated?
In Amelia Island?
I know. Yeah. It's a... Okay, fair. That's all right. There we go. I know. Plus you're 20 too. So don't say anything, you know, let's just say you're 20. Yeah, exactly.
But I think you have to like, you had to go somewhere the following week. So you'd never get to celebrate when you're a tennis player.
That's just the life. That's what everyone says. And that's what, but you got to celebrate again. So let's talk about it because you'd get your second WTA title later that year in Slovenia against Katarina Srebotnik. It must've felt like at that point, I'm just thinking, because again, I know where we're getting to right now and we're building up. Obviously, we're going in chronological order. And I feel like your career is on this trajectory, right? You're playing some great tennis. You're getting to your first quarterfinal. 2007 happens. You win a big title. You win a second title. And things are happening really, really amazing for you. At the end of 2007, you get to two big finals in Zurich and also in Stuttgart, again, losing to Justine, the best player in the world at that point, her and Serena, right? I mean, Justine is, you know, a legend. And then in 2008, you'd start your Australia season just as you normally would. But what would happen in Australia would be something that was not very normal. And it would take a 20-year-old rising star out of the game for 11 years. So can we talk about, I mean, let's just also say you're at 12 in the world at this point too. So there's a lot of feelings here. And I wondered, what was it exactly that took you away from the game? What was the diagnosis? And did it happen in Australia? Is that where it actually happened?
No, not at all. And as you said, I finished 2007 so well. And maybe for the first time, I actually see myself like, okay, my spot is in the top 10 and I'm going to, you know, I've won some tournaments. I've beaten some good players, but now it's time to really step it up in the Grand Slam. So for me, my ambitions are like at the highest and I'm playing well and I'm feeling fit and I have this new coach. I was working with Glenn at the time and I'm like, you know, I'm getting everything on my side to be the best possible player. I'm finally more focused. I'm more serious. I'm more adult. Like I've matured. Everything is going to go my way in 2008 and it's an Olympic year. So I'm like, oh, that could be so fun going with the French team as well. And I've always had back pain throughout my career, but that's just normal. When you're a tennis player, you have aches and pains everywhere. It starts hurting at the Hopman Cup, a little bit more in Sydney after Australian Open. I'm not feeling well. And then there is no diagnosis because it was something at the time that we didn't know what I had. And they're like, okay, take some time off. We're going to do some scans, take some more time off, take some medicine, take, you know, all of that treatment. We have to wait. So we actually didn't have a diagnosis until basically the end of that year. Mm. So it was a really difficult year mentally because you're trying to play. For me, the Olympics was very important. I really wanted to go there. I thought that was something that I deserved and that just with my, I guess, parents and my culture also being in Russia, playing for like their country is very important. So I really wanted to represent France. And it was just a hard year mentally because physically I was used to the pain. I knew what it was to deal with pain, but this was just stopping and starting and not knowing what really the problem was. And mentally for me, that was the most difficult, I guess, year. And when actually I got diagnosed with a spondylitis, which in some ways doctors told me pretty clearly that this is not compatible with professional athletes. But in some ways I was so relieved to actually know what was going on because for a whole year I was basically in doubt of not knowing what was wrong with my body, but at the same time feeling that it's not your regular pain. So it was mixed feelings at the end too, because I'm like, I cannot stop tennis, but at the same time, at least I know what I have.
It's heartbreaking. Your story is really heartbreaking. I mean, you played your last tournament in 2008 in Berlin in May against Caroline Wozniacki. And at that point, was it just unbearable? We couldn't practice anymore. What was the pain threshold? When you would practice, it would just be too much, or you couldn't train and you just wanted to take time off?
I couldn't train. I couldn't. it was kind of fine during the match because it was kind of warm, but then I would start limping. And then the day after, I couldn't walk and I couldn't wake up and get out of bed properly. And it would just be going on all the time. And even when I took time off and when I took medicine or I did treatment, it didn't really work. And that's why it was really scary because like it's not going away. So I wanted to get surgery. I wanted to get like, you know, bigger treatments, but there was nothing that they could do because this is autoimmune. So until they actually did the diagnosis at the end of the year after the Olympics, basically it was just me being in pain all the time. And like I said, the pain was okay, but it was the limping and it was the not knowing why this is happening and why it's not getting better and why nothing that we're doing is getting better.
I mean, when athletes retire, there's always, even if they retire on their own, there's a series of depression afterwards to figure out what you're going to do with your life. If it's something you've known, to have to stop because of your body, I can't imagine. So I'm so sorry. I really am. That's just a terrible, terrible thing. But there were some bright spots and we're going to talk about them in a minute. But I did wonder before we move on, did we think during that time period that you would be able to come back? At what point do you just reserve and say, okay, I'm going to focus on other things right now?
Well, I think after that year where it was the unknown for me, it was important to also mentally, you know, I saw psychologists and I saw a lot of people. And when they told me, and this was also 12, 13 years ago. So it was not compatible with being a professional athlete. And they told me that kind of straight up. And it was kind of like a shock. But in some ways, I wanted them to be honest too, because when you're an athlete and you have so much big dreams, you don't want to also be chasing after something that you will never get. Because at the end of the day, I'm also only 20 years old and you know, I still have a whole life in front of me. So I did need time to kind of, I had to cut everything because I had to understand and kind of acknowledge that I won't be able to train and I won't be able to play tennis anymore. This is a fact. And 13 years later, I don't regret that decision because even when I wanted to play again in 2019, I mean, I'm playing for my personal pleasure, but never competing as a professional athlete should. So this is just, I guess, some ways the path that was written for me. And it's brought me so many great things. And, you know, I wish my kids could play tennis so I could kind of live my dream also through them in some ways. But yeah, I love tennis. I love what it's brought me. And even if it means that I wasn't able to fulfill my dreams, this is all just, it's still just great things from it.
Cherry on top, for sure. You just said it. I mean, you did start a family. You started a new career in broadcasting, but the fire and desire was back at some point. What led you to say, I'm going to do this? What was it that triggered you and said, you know what, I'm going to really give this a shot in 2019 when you made that announcement?
Well, you know, even if I stopped playing and in my head, it was over. I think like I've said this before, but I've had like nightmares or dreams. I'm not sure how you call them, but when you sleep and you're like, okay, I'm in Australia. Oh my God, I forgot my bags. I forgot my rackets. And will I ever be able to play? And deep down you feel like, oh, I wish I could play against the top players. And then, oh my gosh, I can't serve anymore. So I was still living in some ways, like unconsciously, I still had the tennis kind of personality in me and the athlete was still there. So when I was approached, maybe 2017, 18, by some organization for spondylitis to promote and to talk about it, I met a lot of doctors, I met a lot of people, and I spoke to a lot of patients. And, you know, they've been talking about they got new treatments going on, that there are other ways that you can deal with this. And I kind of thought to myself, well, maybe this is my last chance for me to try before I'm, you know, really, really too old, because everybody's playing over 35 years old now. And maybe I can just try and give it a shot. And that's exactly how it happened. I came at Wimbledon in 2018. And I told, we were commentating there with BN, and I came to the house. My whole family was there. So I had like sisters and their kids and everyone. And I said, oh, by the way, after Wimbledon, I'm going to go to Paris and I'm going to start practicing. And nobody paid attention to me. Like, yeah, you just had a tough day. Go back to sleep. Like, go. And that's what happened when I was in Paris. A couple of weeks after that, I started training little by little, see how my back felt, got appointments with doctors again, told them about my plans, and we put on a schedule, and the French Federation helped me again with that. And I was able to play after 6 weeks of training, my first tournament in Luxembourg. So obviously, I don't recommend that. You should never play after 6 weeks of training, but that's just what I wanted to do. I just wanted to get back on the court and live those dreams and nightmares that I had in my head one last time.
Oh, my gosh, that story is amazing. Can we talk about that moment in Luxembourg in October 2019, after 11 years away from the tour? What were those emotions like walking out on that court, Tatiana? Was that just, obviously, I love what you just said. I mean, you were doing it for yourself. You weren't doing it to prove a point to anybody. You were doing this to put an exclamation point on a dream that you had had for so long. And I mean, what a role model for your kids. I mean, that is just amazing. What was that feeling like walking out on that court?
The same as I had, I guess, you know, 10 years ago. And my sister was there watching me. She's like, oh, it looked like you were 16 years old and you're there with your little hat and your racket bag and you're walking on the court. But for me, it was even more the whole being in the lockers and getting ready for that match and preparing and just getting in those rituals again and, you know, practicing, being out in the gym and just having that professional athlete life again. That's kind of something that, you know, I missed and was so much part of me for so many years and that I completely lost because I didn't, after I stopped playing, I didn't go to the gym once. I never picked up a racket. So I didn't like casually play tennis. So for me, just having my racket bag, getting in my sports clothes, being in those lockers, waiting for my name to be called to get out on the tennis court. And then when they announced me and they started saying like, in 2004, in 2006, I'm like, oh, how old am I? What am I doing here on this court? And I'm playing this girl who whose coach came to see me before and was like, you know, we actually watched you play and we're such a big fan of yours. And I'm like, oh, am I in the right spot? And I thought I didn't play that bad in Luxembourg, actually. So it was a really fun experience.
I mean, were you able to enjoy the match? I mean, were you super nervous or did you settle down? Like, at what point did you say, okay, this is coming back. I can do this.
I wasn't nervous at all. I wasn't nervous. Wow. I was enjoying myself. I was kind of doing what I was doing at practice. I felt good. Plain and simple, feeling good.
Why'd you pick Luxembourg?
It was the next, like, I wanted to get the closest tournament possible.
You were just ready. You're just like, I'm going to do this and it's going to be Luxembourg.
Exactly. But that's exactly what it was like. Okay. Which tournament can I get a wild card? Like now, like in the next month. And my agent was like, can you just wait a little bit? Like you're rushing so like quickly into this. I'm like, no, I want to go play now because I don't know if I'll play later. So my point is not to win Luxembourg. I just want to get out on the court and play. And Luxembourg was nice enough to grant me the wild card. So hopped on the train and went.
did playing those two tournaments, did it ease any of the pain of those 11 years? Did it help a little bit heal some wounds of kind of what ifs?
I think so. Luxembourg, definitely. I felt like I could do something. After Luxembourg, though, after that match, were two or three horrific weeks before going to Poitiers, where just my body completely gave up. It was as if mentally I was prepared to go to Luxembourg and give it everything I had. But then after that, my body completely broke down. I had like broke my ribs out of nowhere. You know, I had an elbow issue. But like I said, my preparation was not what you need to really get back on tour. But again, don't regret doing that. But yeah, but then it was more, okay, now the pain is back. You know, how am I going to deal with this? So definitely were more difficult times after Luxembourg than before.
My last question, looking back on your career, which was really a stellar career, and I know it wasn't as long as we all had hoped for, or even you had hoped for. Is there anything now you think you'd do differently, thinking back?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think maybe I wish I was maybe more serious sooner. Like I look at, you know, how professional, even Maria was... I mean, she's very different from me, but she's always so dedicated and professional. And that maybe I lacked a little bit of that when I was younger. And that's why I feel like I've missed some matches and some tournaments just because lack of that structure and that seriousness that she always had. So maybe I would change that. But then I feel like I've learned really well from that too. And that I adapted. And but yeah, I wish I had a bit more years to just kind of play and express myself out on the court.
Yeah. Wow. Emmett, I'd like to close the show today with you. If you have any questions, do you have a question for Tatiana?
I do. And I think you may have answered it in part, at least. The ATP for a long time has had a champions tour where former players who were in the top 10, top 20, achieved various things in their careers, have come back in their retirement and performed on court in front of fans in various capacities. And it's been going on for 20 something years. Do you wish the WTA had something similar so that the players who have retired for any number of reasons, whether it's because they decide to start a family or whether it's because they injury, what have you, takes you out of the game, would have a venue to show off one more time or put those things to bed?
Well, I think I have to be honest. I have two opinions and two visions on this. Yes, I would want women to be able to go back and play if that's what they wanted to, whether, like you said, it's because they start a family, just because they want to go back on the court and they want to compete and they want to have fun and they want to play in front of the crowd. And I'm sure the fans also remember, you know, their favorite players and they would want to see them back on court. But then I also have that second opinion of me where I say, you don't want tennis to be your whole life either. And you want to feel like you can, you know, be successful and that you can be happy doing something outside of tennis, because tennis is just such a big part of your life. And it's, and you, that's why you see a lot of the players, you know, that do go through depressions, because they can't find themselves anywhere outside of tennis. So yes, I want players to continue living and enjoying their tennis, but I also want players that once you do retire, that they're able to find another way, because life is still, you know, very long ahead.
What a great answer. What a great way to end today. Well, honestly, the most amazing part to this whole story is that you get to tell your children to never give up on a dream. You defied the odds by coming back to the court, and you're absolutely a role model because of it. What a fun hour. I want to thank my guests for joining us today. We learned so much. You can find Emmett on Instagram at EJ Stanton, I-N-T-L. Thank you, my friend. It's so nice to see you today. So nice to meet you. Our guest today can be found on Instagram at TatianaGolovin15 or on Twitter at Matryoshka. Did I do that right?
Matryoshka, sure.
Matryoshka. I can't thank you enough, Tatiana. What a great pleasure it was to reminisce
today. Thank you, John. Thank you, Emmett.
And while you're on Instagram, shoot me a DM at John Garica and let me know who you're a big fan of and who you'd like to see on an upcoming show. And don't forget to follow us at Fantastic Tennis Pod or on Twitter at FanTennisPod. My name is John Garica. And thank you for listening. This has been fantastic.
Thank you.